today I'm here with Roger Ehrenberg, who is from Information Arbitrage. He's a Wall Street guy that's turning into an investor in the tech scene in New York. I've been reading Roger's blog for quite a while. He has some pretty interesting books. Roger, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Adrian. Happy to be here.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about you and who you are and what you want to be when you grow up.
Well, still trying to figure that part out, but in terms of where I've been. So, you know, I was on Wall Street for, over 17 years, starting in 87, right around the crash, and I was in M&A. And then for 4 years, I did M&A, focusing on the financial services sector, and then got into capital structuring, which was kind of designing these structured capital instruments for large corporations. And then
I did not.
His heyday was slightly before I came onto the scene, and of course he was based out in L.A. And I ended up going to work for Citi in the old Citi Realty in New York City. So unfortunately, now I've never met Mike. He certainly was dominating the discussion at the time that I got into the business.
Hmm.
And then I went to business school for a couple of years while working for Citi, and then I went into derivatives, which was not at all what I expected I would do. I was much more thinking of going to my side. But kind of my match with Citi had convinced us that I'm the global head of derivatives, and you know, their view was that somebody with my quiz man's background, not from sales and trading, would be actually very effective in advising large corporations on, you know, a couple of my risk management strategies. And you know, I kind of took that bet and ended up being right. And I love being the derivatives markets, and you know, advising large corporates in the 90s was a great time to be doing that, as you know, derivatives, the business just, you know, increased exponentially, and corporate use of derivatives became commonplace. And so I did that from, you know, 93 through that city all the way to the beginning of 99. And then when the Travers merger happened, I did love the way that the culture place changed. And then went to Deutsche to run equity derivatives structuring and origination. And did that through the end of 02, and that was terrific. It was a great, great team, great culture, real kind of can-do attitude. Very exciting time to be on the street. And then I was asked to take over a trading business called TD Advisors, which was a multi-strategy hedge fund platform. It was a combination of running Deutsche Dome capital and running $2 billion client capital. So I was brought in to institutionalize that business and build a risk management culture and institutional infrastructure around it. And I did that for a few years. And then at the end of that, which was end of 04, I decided to leave and to really change my life. And that's why I went to early stage technology investing.
I kind of decided to leave.
So I was asked to restructure the business. The bank decided that the regulatory risk associated with wanting third-party money, given the structure of the business, wasn't worth it, since we made the vast majority of our profits from pure trading on our proprietary capital, that I started to spin out my financials. So QVT, you know, bit New York based on Indora, based in Hong Kong, GSA, which is a top-performing startup fund, Altima, which is a special sit fund based out of London. And once I did that and kind of got rid of the client side of the business and it reverted to being a pure prop trading platform, you know, they said, kind of, what do you want to do? And it was a natural inflection point for me to consider, what do I want to do? And, you know, I really always been in love with technology and kind of consume massive amounts of technology in my decisions on the street and these kind of complex ends of the kind of financial product spectrum. And I started doing some financial investing while I was still at Deutsche. And decided, you know, it's been a great run. And I had a tremendous time, met great people, learned a ton, and decided I wanted to try my hand being on my own.
I mean, you look awesome like you. I mean, you really been up there and done battle on Wall Street. You
had a hand-to-hand combat.
The one comment that I've heard from one guy who was, I guess he was in it for a little while, but basically got out of it, is a fairly high-profile guy. What he told me was he felt like most of the Wall Street spaces is like, were pretty unethical and just aggressive, and he's kind of really all rather unpleasant. Would you agree with that?
No, I think that's it's a very broad brush to paint Wall Street in kind of that negative light. I didn't find it that way. Are there pockets of that? Absolutely. Are there people that themselves are unethical and act in, you know, inappropriate ways? Sure. But, you know, the vast majority of the people that I worked with at Citi and at Deutsche, as well as, you know, friends of other firms, you know, did business the right way. And, you know, did they want to make money? Sure. Did I want to make money? Of course. But that didn't go before giving the right advice to our clients. And if we get, you know, get paid in a way that we felt good about through doing the right things for our clients, kind of a win-win. And I think that's the way I thought most of the street, you know, in my head.
You did leave. Okay, maybe go away. You did leave. I mean, what were your reasons for wanting to move on rather than staying in place?
Sure. So, you know, well, after this, you know, this job, running, you know, a $6 billion RIA, being, you know, reporting to the head of the equity division 2 steps away from Joe Ackerman, you know, I looked around. I didn't really see the roles I wanted. You know, I'd been a banker. I had, you know, been a derivatives professional, you know, on a very high level, and then ran the mass hedge fund. So what other job is there on the street short of running the equity division or running a whole firm that would have been exciting, stimulating, whatever? And honestly, I didn't want either of those jobs if they were available to me, which they weren't. So it was really just a very natural inflection point for me where, you know, I've been fortunate to, you know, make a few bucks in my time on the street and have the ability to go and take personal risk and to really reinvent myself in ways that both kind of balanced my personal and professional objectives and kind of gave me a rebirth. And, you know, the last 5 years, you know, I think arguably I've become a, you know, pretty respected venture investor, I mean, from nowhere. And, you know, taking 5 years of, you know, doing some good stuff, making some mistakes, learning from them, you know, writing a blog, learning how to really become an internet denizen, and just really immersing myself in the community to the point now where I'm part of it.
And here we are talking today. I'm interested from what you've learned from Wall Street. Has much of what you learned there helped you in the startup community?
That's a great question, Adrian. You know, I think probably more than I would have expected. How to build high-performance teams, how to assess talent, how to network, how to manage relationships, how to analyze complex situations. Those are the things that have been invaluable in my transition from Wall Street to kind of the venture investing, startup incubation community.
Have they been really valuable? I mean, if you hadn't learned those things and you were just starting out, you know, when you were a fresh-faced 22-year-old kid and you had the money that you have now, would you still, I mean, you might be a little bit slower, but you still have got there, or do you think it made a tremendous difference to where you are now?
I think both my skills and perspectives made a tremendous difference, and also the fact that I had achieved at the level I did on the street and had the reputation and network of relationships clearly, you know, kind of jump-started me in this new business because people took me seriously, even if I didn't necessarily have the domain expertise when I was first starting out.
Right.
But then, you know, in the venture capital right now.
No,
you think
so?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's how
it goes. You know, it takes time to kind of build one's, you know, tech chops where you're viewed as somebody who understands as opposed to somebody who's just one.
Right.
And, you know, I worked very hard over this, you know, over this period to really connect with entrepreneurs and to really understand the technologies underpinning a lot of the companies I invest in. So, you know, it's a little bit old, all new tricks, but I've learned some new tricks.
Cool. One other thing that I'm interested to ask about some of the Wall Street topics before we move on. You're obviously an MA in Wall Street. Do you think some of your learning there are going to apply to internet stuff? And are you using that or do you plan to?
I would say it does from a tactical standpoint. You know, certainly the kinds of things that acquirers look for, the way to best present a company, creation of key metrics, yeah, I mean, that's helpful. Honestly, MA is technically very easy, you know, except for kind of some more arcane tax rules that heavily impact the way deals are structured. The straight terminal fairway M&A is not complicated. The stuff that's really interesting are the strategies and the tactics, and also the, you know, relationships and the ability to open doors. You know, if you look at the highest profile MA bankers, you know, it's not that they're necessarily structuring gurus, it's that they have an immense amount of trust and credibility with decision makers as potential acquirers and potential targets. So I think that's something also that my legacy relationship with large corporates has been very, very helpful with. And then, you know, the time that I've spent building credibility in the entrepreneurial community has given, and with venture firms, has given me kind of the other side of the equation.
Okay, so now are you an angel investor or a VC investor? Like, what do you say?
kind of way in between. You know, I've made, you know, 35 investments since I started doing this. I've led rounds, I've followed in rounds, I've generally, with my strongly performing companies, I continue to participate in follow-on rounds. So my behavior is very much that of a small venture fund. So obviously, to this point, I've been investing using my own personal capital, not partner capital. But I am in fact going to be starting a small venture fund, or I will have LP capital, which is something I've considered for, you know, quite some time, but I'm going to be doing that shortly.
Why did you decide to do that?
Because it, you know, I, aside from investing, I also incubate, and I've been incubating a trading company for the past 18 months, and it's kind of the intersection of the stuff that I used to do and stuff that I've done over the past 5 years, so it's kind of a mix of quantitative trading and semantic analysis and natural language processing, kind of interesting database architecture to solve very complex problems in the analysis of text portrayal. When I kind of started this project, it's something I don't really talk about very often. I don't really blog about it. It's just something where there's not a PR benefit to it. It's just something that I'm doing myself. But, you know, word kind of got out kind of quietly in the community, and the composition of my personal deal really started to change, where I had been, you know, receiving some kind of classic syntax and then tons of, you know, digital media and ad tech stuff, which is personally where I've invested. But I started to get a lot of really interesting business plans in the sphere of kind of big data. So tools, technologies for the management of massive amounts of data. So database architecture, high-performance computing, and not only detection, predictive analytics, all that kind of stuff. Stuff that directly relates to the work that my company, my trading company, is doing. So and these deals, because of their strategic nature, they didn't feel like angel deals. It felt like I wanted to be bigger and more significant with these companies and to potentially have a joint investment and business relationship with them. Where there would be kind of this discipline of only investing in companies where my trading company could kind of use the technologies, use the analytics, use the data in its own business. So what I decided to do is to identify potential limited partners who themselves were strategic in the sense that they were interested in the same kinds of things that I'm interested in from the standpoint of my trading company, who would want to potentially see the filtered deal flow from the fund, and who themselves could be early betas, potential early paying customers, and in certain cases, potential acquirers of these businesses. And, you know, when I kind of set out with the idea of, wanting to do this fund, there was no way in a million years I was going to go on some typical fund fundraising tour, going to pensions and endowments and kind of doing the standard thing, pretty because I'm not a multiple year institutional VC. My reputation is very much as a super angel investor type person, and so LP capital I didn't think would be there for me. And honestly, I didn't want it because they couldn't be helpful to me. They're probably very heavily restricted on things I wanted to do. So I ended up going to a series of strategics who know me personally, trust me, and at the same time have the interest. So one of the largest data companies in the world, a massive trading company, massive hedge fund, some prominent venture capital investors, a few very prominent entrepreneurs who have built companies and sold companies in the big data realm, like them. So we're kind of LPs and advisors intersect, where every single one of my investors is probably an advisor too, because of their domain knowledge. There's no kind of dead money in the fund. It's all active money. So,
dead money meaning, so I get it, because I'm like so far removed from Wall Street and the idea. So dead money, I guess that means companies, well, people that invest are not involved. They just like sit back and money's being invested. Whereas when you say active money, saying people with actual understanding of the space and potentially the ability to add value.
Precisely.
Right, okay.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when I kind of raised responsibility with this in a small group of kind of trusted strategics, the idea really resonated with them. And, I had the idea 3-4 months ago, and I'm doing it.
Cool.
So it's going to be, you know, again, doing the very early stuff that I do in my capacity as a personal investor, but with, you know, greater higher power to potentially, you know, lead deals, be more significant equity owner of these companies, and then to lead again and assist with the business. And, you know, because my role acts and the ability to help on business development and the fact that I've got, you know, an associate that helps the early companies with their kind of financial modeling and their budgets and their plans, it's a very hand-on approach.
So let me understand, like, you build up a good reputation, you've obviously done a lot of good. What happens if you raise this money? What happens if it, like, all goes down and big qualifies and you lose everyone's money? Like, what happens to you then? Are you, like, shut out from Wall Street and you're done, or does that, like, excessively go on and just start another thing?
That's a great question, Adrian. I have no idea. I mean, you know, my motto has always been failure is not an option, and I don't really, given the 5.5 years of experience I've gotten doing this, I feel like I've learned enough to kind of take a risk-managed approach to building a portfolio and company selection, and the fact that given the strategic nature of the companies in which I'm going to be investing, and the fact that I've got an operating company that can actually do diligence these companies and be a user of their IP, together with a strategic LP, substantially de-risks the investment. So I actually think it's, likelihood of success is very high.
I mean, strategically, it all makes sense. I'm just wondering, like, from the point of view of Silicon Valley, right, it's okay to fail a couple of times in Silicon Valley because you just dust yourself off and get going. It's not like you're going to be, like, locked out of everything in the valley, and people accept that as long as you can handle things right. I was just kind of interested in perception on how that might happen in Wall Street if a similar thing happens.
You would, not on Wall Street. I live in New York, but I'm not on Wall Street. And, you know, my money is, in fact, you know, most of the money, making money on the investment is secondary. What they're really most interested in are the insights to the bleeding edge of technologies that they can actually use in their operating businesses, which has a much greater scale effect than the return on any investment they would be making.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So even then, everything could burn down, as long as they're getting their insights from it, like, you know, then they've done mutually well.
Exactly.
Fascinating. Okay. You mentioned ad tech. Have you been doing anything in that sector?
I have. Yeah.
What kind of stuff have you been investing in?
So, are you familiar with Invite Media?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of companies in the kind of ad optimization, ad server space that I've invested in, and as well as some companies that are less techy but have very scalable platforms that are heavily used by the big brands and by big advertisers, like Buddy Media is a great example, and their Facebook page application. But yeah, no, so ad tech is a very, very important space for me, and something really, it's a place where I can't really add value because it's, you know, the stuff I invest in tends to be very, very data-driven, very quantitative. So, you know, it's, most of the stuff I do, Adrian, has a heavy data component, either directly in that it is consuming and extracting meaning from massive amounts of data, or it is something where the data exhaust actually can be, and metadata can be used in another way, away from kind of the core strategy of business. And that's going to be a divine theme, so ad tech is great for that.
No, I mean, I know the ad tech plays pretty well. Direct response area, I've spent a fair amount of time. So we have quite a lot of mutual friends.
Undoubtedly.
So actually, on that point, so one of my closest friends that we talk a lot about sort of where we're both going to go in the future, and he's made quite a bit of money, and I've made some money. We're sort of like thinking about, well, you know, do we need to work with angels, VCs, and all that sort of stuff, because for a guy like him, he's really good with operations and keeping sort of the mechanics of the company running well. And, I mean, I'm pretty good at the biz dev side and the big picture and that kind of stuff. And we're kind of looking at this and saying, well, do we really need to bring on, I mean, the cost of going down for starting companies, there's more and more angel investing happening. It's more amounts that are being invested. It's forcing the entrepreneur to be frugal and all that sort of stuff. Like, the cost of starting a company overall has just dropped dramatically. And so I understand that it makes sense that angels can do more investing, but is it getting to the point now where individual entrepreneurs can just go incubate a bunch of companies and see what works, and then instead of handing... We have the 10 companies, right? The standard VC model where 5 of them you lose your money, and then 3 of them, or 2 or 3 of them you get some money back, and then one of them is a slam dunk, and you know, one of them does okay, but you make all the returns on the slam dunk. Are the barriers to entry getting low enough now that individual entrepreneurs can go and do that stuff themselves rather than even bring in investment?
I think it really depends on the nature of the business area. I think you're right. You know, the cost of enabling technology is one of them. So the ticket to hacking something together that you can then prototype and even put out there, you know, in alpha is, you know, the barriers are just so low. The reality, though, is that probably most of the entrepreneurs I know don't have the money to even do that multiple times. Even though the cost of enabling technologies has gone down so much, it still costs money. Even the opportunity cost of not working costs money. And to work on a problem nights and weekends, as opposed to saying, I'm really devoting myself to this 150% of the time, you know, leads to a very long, slow, painful death cycle. So if somebody's really wicked passionate about something and decide this is really what they want to do, then most of the time, given the youth and the kind of lack of bankroll that these early entrepreneurs have, it doesn't matter how low the cost of enabling technology is, the opportunity cost of not working is too high.
Mm-hmm.
So they need something. I think what I've seen is that, you know, angels have become the first stop for many, many, many businesses that may or may not need venture capital down the road, but where, you know, $500,000 that's either based on milestones or where, you know, there's an agreement on a very concrete metrics that need to be hit at points in time where by hitting these metrics, you can be more than in a position to either raise additional angel capital or potentially do a venture round if the capital makes the business more of that. Even in, you know, many of these technology-oriented businesses that are very inexpensive to actually hack together, the fact is you still need a sales force. You still need some headcount to actually get the product out there. You know, not everything is a viral online application. In fact, relatively few are viral online applications. So you do need more money to really enter that rapid growth phase because you need feet on the street. So raising $1 million to $2 million is probably going to become necessary to really become successful. So I see it being an evolutionary process, figuring where, yes, a lot of businesses may never need venture money, but will most likely need some degree of angel money? I think the answer is yes.
Okay. You wrote on your blog, you talked about some of the trends that you see happening. I'm interested maybe if you could tell us a little bit about some of your thoughts and where you see things heading from your perspective.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I touched on this, you know, this concept of AFM, and I do think that it's...
Did you read the book Supercrunches?
I did not.
Oh, but then, like, what you read up your app, it's all about, like, using data to analyze and stuff. So a lot of guys in my community have found it very useful.
No, will you send me the link?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, there's so much to read out there, Adrian. I'm just deciding to stay afloat right now.
That's
just going on. So,
where that recommendation originally came from, the guy named Peter Cannon, who runs a company called 24/7 out in Silicon Valley. distributed call center stuff, and I don't know, 6,000-7,000 seats or something like that. They're probably a lot more now. And he said our book was sort of the set the direction for their entire company. So, you know, I'll ask him to link.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, there's kind of the inevitable rise of this kind of wall of data, and managing it, making sense of it, is only going to continue becoming more key, whether you're talking about, you know, anti-terrorism, in government, or, you know, fraud detection in the financial services space, or, you know, data privacy in healthcare, everything from...
Yeah, there's a potential terrorist on a plane, right?
yeah, I don't know, I've been... did any of you read the book, The Looming Tower?
No, I haven't.
Well, I mean, that is an unbelievably damning kind of expose of how, you know, we in the U.S. had access to information, which it would have been quite easy to have stopped the September 11th attacks, but because of a lack of coordination and a lack of unified systems and poor kind of horizontal communication across agencies, it, you know, siloed information told us, literally.
Pretty interesting. I mean, you would think at this point in this day and age that we would be able to manage better a lot better. And, I mean, just recently we had the Nigerian shoe guy in Detroit, right? You would think at this point now that all that stuff can be mined and put together probably, but I guess the analytics aren't still on data.
Well, you know, a lot of the analytics, I mean, it's getting there. There's no question it's getting there, but, you know, once you have the information, what do you do with it? I mean, and that's part of it. It's not a technology problem. It's an organizational structure and a political problem.
So who do you think is leading the way on that? Is it something, I mean, I was thought, if that can be best leveraged, it'll be the Wall Street guys making money on it, or are we going to see it in the fighting terrorism? Is it going to be in credit card fraud? Like, who do you think is leading the way on that sort of stuff?
Well, what you just described is kind of the reason that my thought is that, you know, we're really focused on enabling technologies that can be applied horizontally across these different domains. It's relevant for all the domains. It's relevant for Wall Street in terms of trade identification. It's relevant for government for finding, you know, patterns that would lead to potential data factors, and then financial fraud, you know, data fraud. So there's no question that, you know, an effective IDS system that moves beyond kind of classic rules-based systems, those learnings should be applied broadly across the three sectors we discussed. And that's, yes, I mean, I think that is a huge trend. But it's not just the analysis, it's saying, okay, you need to manage a massive and rapidly growing corpus of data. So kind of classic relational database structures are not necessarily the best answer in a real-time world. So, well, you know, what are new frontiers in database architecture that can help manage this massive amount of data when you want to access much of that data in real time? And, you know, these are the kinds of things. And, of course, you know, analytics, right? So how do you extract meaning not just in terms of looking at things at the packet level, but looking at things thematically over time? How do you look at patterns in data? You know, what are kind of the next frontiers of language analysis that enable us to identify that? Because
you know,
the whole field of notification.
I used to work at Oracle, so just on the side, so I can help you and hook you up with some of the guys at Oracle at a pretty high level on this stuff, like, you know?
No, I appreciate that. Actually, my fund would be backing a new database company. So that's a place where I'm spending a lot of time because we are addressing some very, very complex problems in my trading company, and conventional solutions don't work well. So, yeah, that's one of the things about kind of having this capital is to be able to go and really do some from brick and mortar in these, you know, highly relevant areas.
That's cool stuff. let's see now. What I want to ask you about, let's maybe take a couple steps back. If I want to raise money from you, how do I do that?
you know, if you look at my portfolio, I've been introduced through some channel to virtually all of my deals. So it is very rare, almost impossible, for someone to submit a deal through my blog and how that deal gets done. It doesn't mean I don't want to see it, and it doesn't mean that I don't very much appreciate the opportunity, but what I've found is that the filtering that my network provides, the combination of deal quality and domain focus, is very, very powerful, not to mention kind of the trusted recommendation. So, you know...
We don't know how to fumble down to work. Okay, you're buying off. I get it. I'll deal with it. You know, I'm going to have to look under recovery for a while, but I'll...
That's not it, though, because you know what? I bet you anything, if you're on LinkedIn, and you search for me, and you saw how you are related to me, that you could have something.
Yeah, probably. So for the guys here listening to this that don't know you, like, okay, firstly, you've got to find a way to get to know Russia. So that's the first thing. Now, let's say someone found a way. Let's say I look on LinkedIn and there's two steps in the middle or one step in the middle. There's someone that we know, and, both of us trust that guy. So that guy knows it's acting as a reference for me to come and get money from you. What's then the next step?
So the next step is to...
I am capturing this intentionally in uncomfortable terms, because this is how a lot of entrepreneurs look at it, like, how can I come and get money from that guy? And obviously, you don't want that. You want me to come to you and say, well, could you give me some advice on this particular business idea, right? You want stuff to sell, and the entrepreneur just wants the money.
No, this isn't uncomfortable at all, actually. This is real world. And honestly, I don't have that much time right now for the whole kind of mentoring thing outside of my existing portfolio companies. So I'm focused on the money, too. If I'm not really interested in the business, I don't really have a lot of time for it now to be... sitting down for an hour with every person who wants to do that. I mean, the reality is, I wish I could. I can't.
Right.
I can. But since it dozens and dozens of people every week, so just to follow the question. So, wait, so we know somebody in common. You've got an executive summary, you've got an investor that. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
What you commonly like to do is go to the person that knows us that we have in common, go to them and say, hey, can you please do an email intro? Okay, so let's say Tony Conrad, True Ventures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that True Ventures is going to do this deal for whatever reason. And you say, hey, Tony, you're introducing me to Roger. I understand you guys, you're on LinkedIn, you have a relationship, whatever. Tony says, hey, I know Adrian, really good guy, cool business idea, you should talk to him. Well, if somebody I know in my world says, hey, you should talk to somebody, then I'm going to talk to them, whether it's just I will out of courtesy. And you send along an investor deck and an executive summary. I will do that. And then we have a conversation. And if you're geographically close, you'll come to my office, we'll chat. If not, we'll have a call. And I will know very, very quickly if it's something I want to pursue. It's, for me, I'm very, you say, you're Australian, you're blunt, well, New York, I'm blunt. And, I also appreciate that kind of mealy-mouth BS answers don't help anybody, so I'll be like, just have a, hey, this really resonates with me, this fits well with these three other things that I'm doing. And another thing is, if you knew me well, you'd know that I like to invest in clusters where I've got themes, and I like to invest around existing investments so I can kind of solidify a position in a sector and get an order effect of my company working together. And that's worked very well for me. So, doing some homework on me, I'm eminently due diligenceable, eminently researchable on Google and various social networks. So you should come meet and meet with them to homework, not just, have paid for business me, but what are the kinds of things that might represent my hotlines. And that's really it. So, the key thing is...
You can't listen to this interview.
That's correct.
So let's say they come in, they know, or even let's put, I'll put me in the hot seat. So I've, studied, I know all about Joe. I know you like, you like fishing, and we can talk about some great fishing trip or whatever. Get some things in common, and it's relevant to your themes. What happens then?
Well, do I like your business around? So we thought that was going to come on here to listen. What?
We assume that you do like my business. What happens then? I'm not picking you for money. I don't need it. I'm interested just to understand the process.
Sure. If I like your business, it depends on how much capital you're looking for and do I think your plan makes sense. So that's the thing. So if I like your business, then the question is, does your plan make sense? Because a lot of times I like your business, but the plan doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets to the point of, okay, can the plan be either restructured, repositioned, refined to make it more consistent with what I believe is the right plan? Is the entrepreneur coachable? I mean, do they want a value-added kind of strategic angle, or do they really just want money? And if they just want money, then they should get it from somebody else. If they want it from somebody who is going to challenge them, support them, and mentor them, then I'm a good person to talk to.
So you're one of these top level guys, right?
You can talk to any of the CEOs that I've backed now whose horse I sit. I'm extremely supportive, but at the same time, I'm honest, and I want to be helpful. And, if I think something's not making sense, I'm going to say, hey, I don't think this makes sense. But because of the fact that the only people I back are coachable, they will take that the right way, and they will know certain which is given. So I'm not a meddler, but you're going to know my opinion.
Right. Which would make sense. So let's say you like everything, I've shown you my stuff, we get along, you feel like I'm coachable. What happens then?
Okay, depending on the size of the financing need, and this is me talking, now, is this talking from an angel perspective or from my new little perspective?
Why don't we do both?
Okay, from an angel perspective, invariably, I am not going to represent the whole round. Firstly, I don't do that because I think it's important to have a small syndicate of strategic investors in a given domain. I think if you're going to go for angel financing, and you're going to spend the time and endure the pain, you should get the best investors. But if you can't, that's one thing. That speaks volumes. But if you can, and you have kind of a lead, high-profile angel, then invariably, they'll be able to connect you with other of these angels that will look to this lead angel and take their recommendation very, very seriously. So what I'll generally do next is make some introductions. I will introduce you to kind of 3, 4, 5 angels and VCs whose opinions I respect in the particular domain.
that's one of the form of crowdsourcing deal. I go out, try and convince the other guy to get on board. I say, look, Roger's, you know, moderately interested in his deal. If we get a couple of other guys on board, it's going to go forward. Do you want to look at my stuff?
For me, it's data collection. It's, I'm showing this to other, you know, smart people whose perspective I value. And at the same time, they're potential investors. So we're looking at the syndicated company and buy brand or kind of filling out a white space. And even in terms of VCs, what I'm kind of doing is getting perspective from the next stage financing source who can provide a sense of what things might need to be achieved before this company is suitable for venture financing. So I like, in effect, to kind of pre-sell what and who that ultimate financing source might be. Really the network relationships and the intelligence that you have to get by taking the business again and again and again to these really smart people, which then sometimes will actually modify the plan and modify the thought process, is worth more than the money I'm giving them.
Yes, sir.
And then I say, okay, in parallel, what's happening is I'm talking about, and I'm thinking about what kind of deal makes sense, what valuation, what structure, how big, and then my associate will also be growing the financial model to make sure that, again, we get what we plan, we believe makes sense given the resources and nature of the business, because some businesses subject themselves to needing more money than others. So we don't want to undercapitalize the business. We want to raise the right amount of capital to give it a right amount of runway to hit the right series of milestones to either say, okay, let's raise a little bit more money, kind of the go-to-market capital from angels, or this really requires a $2-3-4 million, let's position it for a proper Series A.
Right. Which now you can do on your own since you raised all the money.
I would still bring in syndicate members, but yeah, I could theoretically lead.
Cool. Okay. Can you talk about, so in terms of the investing that you have done, now given that you've done it for 5 years, you've had some success with the team, it's kind of pretty startling, really. Like, this dude, like, has come to Wall Street, made all his money, he's like, I'm just going to invest in startups, and you're going to do that. It's like, pretty excellent. I haven't heard, like, that many stories just like that. So, keep going out there and doing that. Can you talk about how much overall you did invest in your IRR and that sort of stuff? Obviously, you can't then, just tell me to shut up.
Well, I have no idea what the IRR is because I don't compute unrealized anything, and most of my gains are unrealized, right? Like, you know, my decision to lottery.com is unrealized, but it's worth a lot of money. I've got many investments like that, but how much? You know, several $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the early stage domain, you know, decent chunk of change. And, you know, my investments in my, you know, kind of core companies that have done multiple rounds of financing that are in, you know, rapid growth mode, you know, but several hundred thousand dollars.
Mm-hmm.
I have to start out that high, you know. My median is probably, my median is 100. But I've done 25 and I've done, you know, more.
Right. It would seem like 25 grand isn't a lot of money to get something going in New York City.
No, definitely not. I mean, but when I've not done very many 25s. I've done mostly, kind of, as I said, probably 100 to median, 50 is probably the next most frequent. And then 25, I've done a handful. And for me, 25 generally reflect businesses where I like the apps more, where I like the syndicate, where I may like the technology, and I want to learn. I want to keep an eye on it. I want to get close to people. There's some other motivation besides for financial return.
But you think it's to get an interesting pace and keep on.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm not expecting any of those payoffs to be $25,000 in Google, but it's more strategic to me as an investor.
Yeah, right. Cool. We're running out of time. Is there anything you want to talk about that we haven't covered?
Geez, I'm exhausted. I don't know, Adrian. I think you did a pretty good job giving me a long list of psychological.
I'm not even going to comment on that.
Well, you said you're very good at your job.
Yeah, well, I've got to ask the questions. What do you think? Good things for taking them and answering them all?
No problem, Adrian.
Really appreciate your time.
Okay, good afternoon.